So Heter Iska Lamaisa. We have to just review a few things. Step number one, there are multiple mitzvahs from the Torah to lend people who need money, and to do it interest-free. Number one. So, if people need money, the right thing to do is to lend them money without charging them interest. That would not be the case when it comes to lending them money to go to a business venture. Then there's no reason in the world, you could be nice, lend them money at no interest, but then there becomes no reason in the world why you can't
participate.
Yeah, lend them money and be a partner. And that partnership can be structured in a way that's mutually agreeable, however that will be. There's no reason in the world why not to do that. You can be a tzaddik and give money to someone so they can get on their feet, but there's no reason why you can't lend the money and expect some sort of return as being a partner in their business. Now, if you remember the Mishnah we saw, they introduced the idea of iska, because that's where the word heter iska is going to come from.
Iska means business.
Iska means a business, yeah. But it's a term of art here. It means a particular kind of thing. It was the classic iska setup that the Mishnah set up, and that your classic heter iska is relying upon is the relationship the palga milva and palva pikadon, the relationship where half of the money I'm giving you, recall back to the Mishnah here, the half the money I'm giving you is considered to be a deposit and half is considered to be a loan. Now, the idea, that was a technical setup. The idea, conceptually, of the ISKA partnership, a regular business deal. Don't start thinking yet about loans yet. Just think about calling the Mishnah a real bona fide business agreement. We're going into partnership. We had two partners with what I call the provider of the capital and the provider of the labor. So I'll provide you the capital. I think we had paper, we had wine bottles, we had wheat, and different illustrations. I'll provide you with the wine bottles, and I'm the provider of the capital, and you're going to sell the wine bottles, and we're going to split the profit. But not only are we going to split the profit, we are also going to share the liability, and if there would be losses, then you would be on the hook for those losses. That's your ISKA, your classic ISKA setup. And it's looked at as being, since we're sharing 50% of the profit, 50% of the loss, it's looked at as being half, the provider of capital is giving half the money as a pikadon, as a deposit, and half the money as a halva, as a loan. Now the reason why that is critical, step one, is because the standards of liability for money you borrow as a loan are different for the borrower than are the standards of liability from someone who keeps something on deposit. If I'm going to give you this money on deposit and we're going to business together, whatever it is, so then you are, you've seen the shomrim, you are a shomer sachar, you're a paid custodian. A paid custodian is responsible for things that he could have avoided if he'd been more responsible. Like Geneva and Aveda, like thieves stealing things because he didn't lock it up properly. Or Aveda, he left it in the sun and it got ruined. Or if he left it, that's a Shia maybe, where he left it where he lost it. Simple case, he lost it. But any avoidable loss. If he would have been more scrupulous and more careful, the unexpected event wouldn't have happened. Okay? That's a Shomer Sacher's liability. Meaning, just to, you know, that's what I want, to contrast that to the other Shomerim. When it comes to Shomer Chinam, the Shomer is just doing the custodian is just doing a favor. And he's watching it because he's doing, your next door neighbor is watching your stuff for a few minutes or a few hours. So then he's a shomer chinam, an unpaid watchman, and he's just doing you all favor. He would not be responsible for those things, the ganev and aveda, the loss that could have been avoided if he would have tried harder, that he would not be responsible for. All he'd be responsible for is shia negligence. In other words, what he did could be anticipated to cause loss, that would be forbidden. In other words, I don't anticipate someone to break into the house. But if I didn't lock the door, so in a place like Beit Shemesh, that would not be considered a Shia. People don't break into houses on a regular basis, I don't think. So that would be considered a Veda or Gnei. That would be considered theft. So a shomer chinam would be considered, I would think, not poshe on that. I left it in my drawer, on my desk. I didn't expect someone to break in my house. I mean, for goodness sakes. But Shia would be if I left it in front of my house and came back half an hour later expecting it to be there. Well, things disappear. So that would be negligence. So a shomer chinam, an unpaid watchman, just bringing the issues together here, would be responsible only for negligence, pshia. But but like I'll call it foreseeable losses that he just wasn't careful enough about, Ganeva Neveda, those he would not be responsible for. The Shomer Sachar, this is your business partner here, since he's being compensated, he's going to partnership, he takes on the liability also of Ganeva Neveda, loss that he could avoid if he'd have tried harder. Under both those kinds of Shomrim, and this is very important for our Iska situation, are not responsible for what's called onus, circumstances beyond the watchman's control. So in other words, even if I lock my house with 10 locks and bolts, it's not going to stop the tsunami from washing everything away. And I live in Beit Shemesh, I do not anticipate any tsunamis to come. Right? So if a tsunami comes and washes it all away, what do you want from me? I'm an onus. Totally beyond my control. Anything beyond my control, a fire, a lightning bolt, it shouldn't just be an act of God. Anything that's totally unforeseeable. I don't know, the pipes in my house burst. I wasn't negligent, that is, the pipes burst, and you had given me something that is, you know, your painting, and now it's ruined. I'm sorry, I did what I could as a reasonable shomer. That's onus, beyond my control, or I'll be putter. So.
So if you locked in the door, you have 10 locks, and the bars, and everything on it, and some professional guy that has special tools.
Onus. If you remember back to, and when we were talking back in Hakonas, I was talking about you'd ask that we were talking about guarding animals. So the example I gave is you'd ask the, you know, the animal storage expert, will this animal get out? And if the guy says no, the animal won't get out, then it's already beyond that. It's considered onus. I retract what I said. No. Why did I retract it? I just don't want to. That I was actually illustrating that discussion. I was illustrating between Shmir Ma'ula and Shmir Pechusa. It's a little different. But anyways, the point. So I'm to retract that example. But indeed, the point is, if I did what any reasonable person could expect it to do, and after the event, you can always say, you know, well, obviously something bad happens. Obviously, if you'd taken different precautions, something that could have been protected. That's not fair. But going into it, before something happened, if I'd ask a regular citizen of, you know, responsible citizen of Beit Shemesh, this is how I'd lock my door. Is this a reasonable way to protect stuff? They would say that's perfectly reasonable, and no reason to expect in the world that in the next 100 years anything will happen to it. But something did happen to it, because people, if someone wants to break into your house, they can get in, period. So that's called onus, beyond your control. It's the same as a pipe bursting and a hurricane coming. It's a thief that's determined to get into your house no matter what. All that's your onus, beyond your control, and you're, as a shomer, as a custodian, you are, as a shomer chidim or shomer sachar, you would be exempt from that. So the half of the money coming to the provider of the labor in the iska, if he's getting it as a pikadon, he's off the hook for things that happen beyond his control. Okay, so he's shouldering zero liability. For the pikadon. When I say zero liability, I mean liability beyond what he could be responsible for.
If the money is stolen,
he's not responsible. If the money is, he's a shomer sachar, he would be responsible. He would be responsible, but not if he locked the. If it was stolen, yeah. If it was stolen because he didn't lock the doors properly, then he's obligated. A shomer chidim wouldn't be, a shomer sachar wouldn't be, but he's only potter for things beyond his control. Like he did what everything any reasonable person would have done, and still something bad happened. So there's no, I'll call that no liability here. So I'm not sharing the loss. The other half, therefore, is the loan. Since the provider of labor is on the hook for 50% of the liability, it must be he's on the hook for the loan, a loan portion. Because when it comes to halva, a loan, that's when you shoulder responsibility, period. Normally, when I give you money, if you're a shoel, that's the other kind of custodian, you're a borrower, or I'm lending you money. In both those cases, you're the beneficiary. I'm doing you the favor. So since I'm doing you the favor, I don't want excuses. I want my money back. And that's that. So it's on the halva'a part, it's on the loan part, that the provider of labor, the salesman, is shouldering the responsibility. So that, remember, we had the drawing on the board. We had 1,000 bottles of wine at $10 a pop. Said $10,000 total was all the money, and we said we were expecting to sell it for $16. That was the example I gave. So then $16,000 is the anticipated total profit. $10,000 would go back to the original provider of capital, and the remaining $6,000 in profit would be shared 50-50, $3,000 to you, $3,000 to me. So then we said, I'm just rehearsing the Mishnah. So then we said, that's all cool. The problem is, wait a second. If half the money is a loan and half the money is a pikadon, So I'm giving you $3,000. I can't be giving $3,000 for the return for the loan. That won't wash because that would be interest. So in other words, on the one hand, we have to have a loan in the mix because there's liability. That's critical. If there would be no liability, there would be no loan. But since there's liability, there must be a loan in the mix. If there's a loan in the mix, I can't pay you interest. So if I'm paying you something, it must be for the picadon part. So now, then it comes out like this. We're 50-50 partners. Half the money was given to me as a loan, half the money as a deposit. If I'm giving you the money, I'm giving you the $3,000 in profit I'm giving you isn't for the loan, it must be for the picadon. So I'm giving you all the 50%, all the profits that are generated are coming from your deposit. So then it comes out, wait a second. You've given me, 500 bottles as a loan. And I sold them and I'm giving you back the money. You loan me $500 worth of 500 bottles or $5,000, the value of the wine. And I can keep all the profits because I'm giving you interest, right? So that means that if I'm giving you anything, it must be coming from the fact that you gave me another 500 bottles and I'm selling them for you and I'm giving you the profits. But wait a second. If they're all your bottles of wine and I'm selling them for you and I'm giving you the profits, I'm working for you for free. Right? I'm selling your half and giving you all the profits. That's a little fishy. Why in the world would I be working for free for you? I mean, I can be a nice guy too. There's nothing wrong with doing you a favor and selling something on your behalf. But it becomes very problematic if we have a concurrent loan going on. If there's a loan going on, I'm doing you a favor by selling your wine on deposit to me and giving you all the profits, I'm doing you a service, and since I have a loan out, you're really getting interest. You're getting backhanded interest. Maybe it's only in the dura, but it's a benefit. Any benefit is ribbis. Yeah, correct. Interest is a bad word, but you're getting ribbis. You're getting some value. It's not a Doraisa issue necessarily because we didn't agree to it ahead of time. There's a possibility of loss, not guaranteed, yada yada. But it's certainly Midrabanan looks horrible because it looks like I'm working for you and giving you the, in exchange for you giving me a loan. So therefore, the rabbi said, you have to compensate me. I think I've traded rolled back and forth here. You have to compensate the provider of labor. The salesman has to be provided, has to be compensated by the provider of capital. He has to give money. So in addition to splitting it 50-50, the person who's providing the wine bottles has to pay the guy, the seller, by the hour, or something, has to pay him something. And we saw as the Mishnah went on, it could be any something. We were discussing it could have been use of the animal, if the animal provided some value. Right? We provided...
Value received.
Exactly. Every contract always says for value received, and the value could be anything. Right? And that will come into play here, because when we get to Heter Iskas, the value received could be any amount, nominal. We never, if you remember, I emphasize that as we went through the Mishnayos, we're not looking at, because remember we had like offsetting, we said, for example, instead of wine bottles, I'm giving you animals to raise. And we're going to split the profits of the increase in the value of the animals. So we said the same thing. If they're little animals that can't produce, the same deal, 50-50, I have to pay you by the hour, and even have to pay for half of the animal feed, etc. But then we said, oh, if they're big animals and they can do labor, like they're draft animals, they can shoulder a burden, or they can make eggs, whatever the story would be. So then we said at that point, I don't have to pay you by the hour, as long as they say you can get the benefit of the labor. We didn't actually make a cheshbon. It could actually be, if you do the math, that the difference between that labor this thing produces and the labor you have to put into it and the feeding of the animals, all that kind of business, they come out to being, pennies. It doesn't matter. Once I'm getting some compensation, once the worker is getting some compensation, we can ascribe that compensation for the work done for the picadon and not for the loan. Right? Is it clear? Okay. Now, all that's good. So now, that's all the background. Now here's what happens. I need money. I'm rehearsing just for reviewing what I said so far. Step one, what I said is, when it comes to lending money, you ought to do it, ideally, as a free loan. The Torah mandates that. It's a mitzvah. It's multiple mitzvahs. The person's in need. You have lots of mitzvahs. The Chavetz Chaim and Avos Chesed lists out all the different mitzvahs you get, and he speaks out how important it is to do free lending, that he says a third of your money, of your charitable money giving, should be given towards free loans. It's a mitzvah. It's a great, tremendous mitzvah. Number one. Number two, I said, there's no such thing exists if I'm going into partnership. If I need money not for a personal loan, but for a business, so there's no reason in the world why you could lend me money, because of the hate, and if I'm in need, you have all those mitzvahs too.
That's interesting, but that he counts that of the miser money, even though you're supposed to give a tenth, but a third of that tenth can be returned to you.
Well, then you have to go in circulation, so to speak. But to set aside, I'm allocating...
Open loan.
Right, revolving loan or whatever it is exactly. So, if it's a real bona fide business, I'm providing the working capital for. There's no reason in the world why I can't go into partnership with you. I'm not even like outside the spirit of the law necessarily. Okay, I could get a mitzvah, but I'm not outside the spirit of the law. Argument could be made strongly that if I'm going to try to, if you just need money because you have no money, and I give it to you as a free as a loan, and I structure it using this heter iska business, that could already be argued. That's even if it's kosher by letter of the law, it's certainly not in the spirit of the law anymore. Perhaps.
Does it can
even apply to a business? Yes, I'm discussing that right now. Can it ever apply to a personal loan? So I'm getting to that now. But I'm saying it's more. It can and it does and it's halachically fine. But there are poskim who don't like it, even though the consensus is you could. The reason we'll speak out more. But the reason why is because you're really it's a subterfuge. You're going to end up giving a personal loan and charging interest on it. But if it's not interest. It's just partnership, which is a little funny. Partnership in what? Okay, so
there's a real estate involved.
Well, it depends. So one thing at a time. I'm going to move through it piece by piece. So let's first talk about the simpler case, which is simply that you need money to make a living, and you have a wine shop, and you just need money. Times are tough, or your shop got broken into, or whatever the story is, and you need working capital. So I say, listen, I'll lend you the money, you'll pay me back with interest, that's no good. But what I could say is, you need $10,000 to restock your shop. I can say, I'll give you $10,000, and I'm expecting to get paid back $11,000, but not because I'm lending you at interest, but because I'm becoming a partner in your shop. And we will, ahead of time, when I go into partnership with you, there are lots of ways we could structure the partnership. We could structure it in a way that I'm getting a 50% of the profits unlimited. We could specify ahead of time it's capped. There's a minimum, there's a maximum, whatever we'd want to do. And that is how the head to ISCA is going to go. That I'm lending you the $10,000, and we're saying ahead of time, oh, we're anticipating that this shop is going to, you know, get to 20% return on equity. You know, every dollar you put in pumps out 20 cents. So I'm giving you $10,000. We're anticipating that it's going to put out. I should have said something else. Let's say I want the 10%. That's what I want, the 10%. I want 10% return on my money. So we could say, listen, this wine shop is anticipated to return 20% return on equity. If I give you $10,000, we should expect that by the end of the year, you know, $12,000 should come out of the thing. So we'll say, listen, in our contract, we'll say, we're anticipating the thing's going to produce, you know, for $10,000, $12,000 will come out, and we're agreeing to split that profit 50-50. So I'm agreeing, so you, the borrower, but you're not, yeah, you, the recipient of the money, partial borrower, partial person, we're anticipating that there'll be $2,000 in profit, in addition to $10,000 in principal, and that will be returned, $1,000 to you, $1,000 to me. We can specify that on the contract.
So the translation of ISCA is really investment.
Correct. But we're going to, yes, I'll even translate, I want to stick to this business partnership, only because, investment is just fine. Yeah, exactly. So, if that's the case, what happens is we set it up ahead of time that I'm going to partnership with you. We're not going to bother with, you know, the modern version of what percentage ownership I have in the LLC or how many shares you're issuing me. We're not doing that. We're doing simply, for the money I'm putting in, I'm expecting to be partnered with you to get out, you know. And we'll actually specify anticipated profit is 20%, and we're going to split that 50-50, so that means you're going to give me back 10% of the profit. Now, what we'll do then, I'm like building into how they, we'll see ISCA contract inside, but I'm just stepping the steps in. What we'll do then is we'll say, listen, the truth is you as the recipient of the money are on the hook if something goes wrong. But how can I ever trust you that you say something went wrong and therefore the money's gone? How can I ever trust you? So what we can do is we can make stipulations about the standards that will be required for me to accept that you say money got lost. And if you don't meet those requirements, then I will not accept the money got lost, and you have to pay me back in full anyways. So the Truman suggestion, this is how many, many of these things work, but I don't think the one, many of these things work, is we specify two witnesses, or with their particular witnesses, or just witnesses in general. We say, oh, that me, the provider of capital to you, will not accept your argument that the money got lost unless two kosher witnesses, or these particular kosher witnesses who have some knowledge of the business, whatever it is, will swear to me, or testify to me, as they testify in front of Basin to me, that the money was really lost. Now that puts it's very hard to prove. Right? In other words, let's say we pick two particular people. It doesn't have to be. Like, who the heck's going to know for certain that really the money was lost and you didn't pilfer it and it wasn't a bad decision and it wasn't really it's missing and you haven't just cooked the books? That's very hard to prove. So what happens is essentially then, de facto, what I've essentially done here is say that you're paying back in full. Because there's no way for you to pay less than full, because to pay back less than full, you'd have to prove that the money is missing by the witnesses, which is a very high burden of proof and hard to do. The other way around it, I shouldn't say that's a terrible way of putting it, the other way of structuring it, where it forces the hand of the person who received the money to get back in full, is to say that he would have to swear. Remember, we had this, the shvuah to show me, have to swear that the money was really lost. And he has the option, you either swear the money's lost, or you can opt not to swear the money's lost, but in which case he has to pay. If you remember back from the Shavuos HaShomrim from the beginning, and no one's going to want to swear the money's lost, presumably. So again, if you fail to swear to me, you don't want to swear, you're not going to swear, then that means paying back in full. Either way, what that's done, by putting the clause that the witness needs to testify or the oath needs to be made, that assuming that the borrower, the receiver of the money, doesn't make the oath or doesn't bring the witnesses, the principal's paid back in full. Not only that, but we can say that we agreed ahead of time that the anticipated profit was 20%. So that can go in the anticipated profit also. So now essentially what's happened is, unless the person receiving the money is going to bring witnesses and or swear, the provider of capital can say, either you swear and or bring me those witnesses that we need, otherwise you're paying back my principal plus the 10% interest that is my anticipated fair share, because I don't believe that anything less than that happened. So as long as the provider of capital doesn't know for certain that the money wasn't made, then he's allowed to receive that. Obviously, he can't make the person do something he knows isn't true. And then what you've done backhandedly is forced the receiver of capital to pay back principal plus the preset amount of money that was anticipated to be made. So you've structured as a business transaction where the principal plus essentially interest is not literally guaranteed, but is very likely to come back to me, the lender provider of the capital, because you're not going to swear or bring witnesses to the contrary that it's not deserving and coming to me. That's the basic setup of the ISCA relationship when it comes to a business transaction. So I'm going to read you the contract. Here's an ISCA contract from this book. This is the Ryzen book. He actually provides this. You can photocopy it and print it out for yourself. If you're going to lend money to someone, this contract is for a business. So we'll go through it, and you'll see this is all kind of very familiar now. You see how it goes. It says, I, the undersigned, this is going to be the receiver of the the provider of labor, have received the sum of, fill in the blank, from, sum of $10,000, I'll fill in the blanks, from the provider of the capital, whoever his name is, hereafter referred to as the investing partner. Okay, so I use it as provider of capital, they're calling it as investing partner. They're going to refer to it as investing partner as opposed to the managing partner. Okay, but it's a partnership. To be used for business purposes, I, that's the provider of labor, right, the managing partner, obligate myself to utilize these funds in a manner which I believe will generate profits. In my wine shop, whatever it is. Any profits realized or losses sustained shall be shared equally between the investing partner and myself. Yeah, so that I'm agreeing. Profits and losses shared 50-50. So now we've got half it is a picadon, right? And half it is a halva. Now, any claim of loss must be verified through the testimony of two qualified witnesses in and under conditions acceptable to an Orthodox Jewish court of law. So now, if I'm not going to pay back in full of the principal, I need to bring witnesses that testify that I'm not going to have to pay back, which is very difficult to do. My intention is to really wiggle away and not pay you back. It's very hard for me to not pay you back principally anymore because I've agreed that I need two witnesses, and who the heck is going to swear that under oath, who's going to testify that they know for a fact the money is lost. Any claim regarding the amount of profit generated by these funds, I'm talking profit, not loss, shall be verified under a solemn oath. In other words, if I want to say that anything other than the anticipated amount we're going to say now, I have to take a shvuah that it wasn't the 20% we anticipated, before under conditions acceptable to an Orthodox Jewish court of law. So that's also making it unlikely that I will be able to suggest any number other than the 20% that we anticipated. Here it is, the anticipation. It is agreed that if I return the above-mentioned principal to the partner, the investing partner who provided the $10,000, together with an additional fill-in-the-blank $1,000, that would be the 10%, right, as payments for his share of the profits which are generated. So we're agreeing now we're going to cap it or fix it at 10% essentially by saying $1,000 in exchange for the $10,000 you gave me. Then I will not be required to make any further payments, nor will I be required to make an oath. So we said ahead of time what we anticipate the profits to be, and if I do anything other than give you exactly what you anticipated, you know, principal plus 10%, then I would have to bring witnesses on the principal or make an oath to shvu on the other 10%, and that's not going to happen, probably. I'm obligated to make this payment on or before fill in the blank, so you give a date of returning the profits. If payment is not made by this time, the terms of this iska shall continue, so it continues on. Fine. So now remember, by the way, that would mean, just speaking it out, the rate of return is going to be impacted here. In other words, what I'm agreeing is I'm paying you back $1,000 plus the principal. So if that takes, if it's in 1 year as I anticipated, and we said, you'll effectively get a 10% rate of return. If it takes until 2 years to pay you back, so you end up getting a 5% rate of return. Because we fixed ahead of time, I'm giving you $10,000, not 10%. Okay? You could have done, I have received, now the next paragraph says, that's the person received doing the labor, I have received $1 from the investing partner as payment for my services during our term of the partnership. So that will happen is, at the time the ISCA is drawn up, the contract, the provider of capital will also, in addition to providing the capital, give an extra dollar, and that dollar will serve as the nominal value received by the provider of labor, so that that's his compensation for the selling of the Picadome part. So it could be any amount.
It could be an extra. It could be one of the...
Okay, but
it has to be designated.
Right, there's two ways to go. Either exactly. It was otherwise, it could be the principal was 9999. Same thing, of course. The other way to do it, by the way, this contract doesn't do it, but then would be another way, which would be instead of providing a dollar, which some people don't like because it seems just, you know, perfunctory, is to say that although the losses are split 50-50, the profits are going to be split 55-45. Right? That's equivalent of you having something comparable to having use of the animal, whatever the story is. I'm getting other value. I'm getting other value. Since the profits and losses are not split equally, we're 50-50 loss, but 55 are the profits, I'm getting compensated in a different way instead of for a dollar of cash, whatever it is. Fine. In the event of any conflict between the terms of this ISCA agreement and the terms of any other agreement signed by the two parties in this regard, in regard to these funds, the terms of this agreement shall prevail. What we want, of course, is that the Heter ISCA is paramount. The agreement shall follow the guidelines of Heter ISCA as explained by Sefer Bris Yehuda. You know, then we want to reference all the sub-clauses over there. It's agreed that any dispute which may arise in connection with this agreement shall be submitted before filling the basis in of your choosing, that's optional, just this contract is suggesting it. And judgment rendered by the aforesaid authority may be entered in any court having jurisdiction thereof. So you can put it by a rub, by a basement, whatever you want. We're going to agree ahead of time how we're going to adjudicate. Normal contracts have that. And dated such and such, signature of the recipient, signature of the investor, and then optional witnesses if you want, who can testify that they witnessed it. That's it. So that ISCA contract.
What's interesting is that all the Israeli banks had this.
Okay, so now the banks are a little different. I'll get to the banks third. Oh, well, I'll address banks right now. This contract does require. You see, it's like a personal relationship, me and you, which is all fine and good if you're dealing with a loan from me to you or money from me to you. If you're working with a bank and every time you're making any transactions, interest accruing and interest being paid on everything, obviously it becomes a nightmare. Just a logistical nightmare. So what the banks will do, and this is all the banks will do this, I believe, is they will have in their basic, you know, when you sign up for your bank account and you sign up to take your loan out from the bank, they don't have a separate ISCA contract. What they do is the same way this thing referenced, it said everything here is subject to the guidelines of Sefer Bris Yehuda. So their contracts will say when you open the account is something like all the transactions we're doing through the bank are subject to the bank's Heter ISCA Klali, and they have this, you know, on the wall, which is referenced throughout. So the bank essentially has this ISCA agreement with everybody. So when you go into the bank, you're agreeing to become a partner with the bank in as much as sharing the profits and losses, and it's paid out based on the, you know, whatever interest rates are specified at the time and place.
Does that protect the person in bank say as well? It protects the bank. What about you who open an account there? Are you protected by that?
You're halachically protected in terms of being over the Isurim?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Because we're saying all the transactions we're doing are subject to Heter Iska. Okay?
That's from the bank's point of view, but from, from your point of view.
No, you're well. The heter is the klali, and I mentioned both sides of the transaction. If I'm the lender or I'm the borrower, so to speak.
So you only need one heter is the
transaction. Yes. Yeah. Well, now yes, correct. Now remember, as you're asking a good question. As a client of the bank, you can sometimes be the lender, and sometimes you can be the borrower, yeah. Right? So, but their heter is klali will cover both sides of the story.
And what about bank charges?
Well, that's okay. What's the problem with that?
That's better.
Yeah.
But I'm saying if they charge an additional amount as bank charge.
That's okay. Bank, that's regular. I'm a loss. That's reasonable for any service provider. The problem is, yeah, the big problem with the banks is that when you walk to the bank, they tell you you're getting 5% interest on your money. That's like the massive red flag. So we get around that by saying it's not really interest. It's like the bank is an operating business, and I'm going to partnership with it. It needs operating capital to extend loans to people to do mortgages. I'm making deposits. Those are my partnership with the bank, and the bank's going to pay me 5%, you know, anticipated profits on the loans it makes. And that's, so the bank essentially is going to, the one half of the Heter Iska Klali will say this kind of thing. We're agreeing that when you give me money, I'm paying you back at the specified rates. And the rates are not interest rates per se, but they're anticipated rates of return based on the bank's business at that time. And the same, they'll also mention the way around. If you're acting as a borrower, because you're taking out a mortgage, so again, the bank is lending to you, and it's going to be subject to its conditions of partnership with you. Now, I should have been given a better example. Just if you're going to borrow money from the bank to build as a business loan, you know, to make money to build a shop, whatever it is, it's subject to the same conditions as this contract here. Now, what I haven't discussed yet is this all makes sense if there's a business here. How can we possibly write this up as a business and a business profit sharing and everything in the event that there's no business here? You're hard up for cash and I'm lending you money. So what happens is there's another way to go, which is the money being extended for personal use. The contract is the exact same contract, essentially. The difference is going to be that instead of me giving us going to partnership with a particular business, what we hope will happen, this is like, let's assume this is true for now, that the borrower has some income-producing asset somewhere. Maybe it's his business, maybe it's his house he rents out, maybe it's anything.
The house he lives in.
What? Well, now a residential home is problematic because it's not income-producing. It doesn't generate.
It could theoretically.
But yes, it could theoretically. So some say yes, and some say some say it's really just theoretical. There's no actual money being made here, right? Especially if property prices are relatively stable, et cetera, it's hard to say we anticipate profits from this. Because what are you talking about? Single family residential. But even let's say yes. So if there's something going on, if the borrower has anything cooking, they have a, you know, they're an accountant and they have an accountancy practice and they have a contract with an accountant, whatever it is. Whatever the story is, if he's got something going on, then it becomes doable. What happens is when I extend the loan to you, I extend it to you as a partner, but not in this. Even though I know that $10,000 I'm giving you now is for you to pay for your child's medical bills, which are unexpected. But I'm not going to say I'm partnering in your kid's medical bills. That doesn't ask there. What I'm saying is, you have other assets floating around, like your business. And if I wouldn't give you the money, you'd be forced to sell your business to pay your kids' medical bills. So I'm saying what I'm doing is I'm becoming a part of you in your business, your real estate, your anything, anywhere, somewhere, somehow that's going to produce income. I'm becoming a partner in that so that you don't have to sell it, and then you have working capital, which you can use to pay your kids' medical bills. So that would be a better case where you have something. So the contract is going to be, I'll read it to you, the first part is different, the second part is the same. So this is a contract where the borrower is explicitly not taking the money that he's getting to invest in some business. They're taking the money for personal use. But again, we're assuming he has something somewhere going elsewhere. So the contract says, and this is a boilerplate contract, you can use it just as is. I, the undersigned, have received the sum of fill-in-the-blank dollars from fill-in-the-blank, the person who is referred to as the investing partner. So you're still talking about investing partners, no interest, no mention of loan. If you'd say loans and interest, the whole thing becomes puzzle, potentially. For investments in an ISCA partnership subject to the following terms. In exchange for the aforementioned sum, the investing partner shall acquire a share in, there you go, the value of the funds received in any investments, his stock portfolio or whatever, or real estate, let's say even his house, or business, if he has a practice, which I own. Right? So it's something. Now, That's the hope that's something there. But if there's nothing, in the event that no such investments exist, then the investing partner will acquire partnership in the value of the funds, in the amount of the value of those funds received, in any future investments which I shall make. So that's like your, that's your final catch-all. If there's nothing, then you say, if anything comes in the future, that's the part I'm giving you now, so in the future. We have to hook it onto some profits somewhere, so it'll be future profits. And then the same structure, the investing partner hereby appoints me, the provider of labor, as the agent to execute the investments, as I deem appropriate on his behalf, and will share the loss and profits 50-50, and it's anticipated such and such, and if I don't deliver it, then I have to bring my witnesses for the principal, and I have to, then it becomes the same as before. So, the same exact story. So that's how the Heter Iska personally just works. This is, some poskim don't like this already. I'll call this three shlavim. Shlav A, which is it's like, fine, is where there's a business I'm providing money for. Then what's the problem? No, there's no problem at all. I could become an equity partner with you, so I'm providing someone who's getting fixed payments. B, is if at least there's something to hook on to. I'm giving you a private loan for your kids' medical bills, but listen, you have another business, so I'm becoming a partner in your business. That's normal. That's okay. A business or a practice or a real estate, something. C is when there's actually nothing. The guy's totally destitute. So, and I'm providing you money anyways. So then there are more posts that don't like it anymore. A, the Torah definitely had in mind you should lend to this person for free, period. So you don't want to do that for whatever reason. You're not going to do that. No one's going to do it, so you have to provide them cash. Fine. But the problem is, it's very difficult. There are those who say this really looks like a sham now because there's no partnership in what? But anyways, so certainly best to act as a free lender, but if you can't, then you rely on these opinions. You rely on this. You're still doing better than nothing, right? You're still providing the guy with a way out, that you're a partner with him in his future business dealings, whatever they may be. Okay, fine. But so that's how the Heter Iska works. The banks Heter Iska, now Kali will reference the same kind of thing, that when that's why I backed away from a residential mortgage. The problem with a residential mortgage is not producing income, so it's hard to say it's a business, but again, you could say it'd tuck as a business, because when the guy sells it, there'll be profits, and we're anticipating ahead of time what the profits will be. Now, So that's the basic gist of it. There are other kinds of contracts floating around, other kinds of issues that deal with different kinds of problems. Like if you want monthly payments, then you have there'll be a variation because you talk about anticipated monthly receipts. There's another kind of contract that floats around you might see, which is structured like it's a newfangled halachic innovation, if you will, which is instead of being palga pikadon and half halva, it's kulo pikadon. So in other words, I'm not giving any loan, I'm receiving a pure deposit for return. It's sort of like when the bed sheet is a little short, so if you want to cover your head and your feet get uncovered, you don't cover your feet and you're cold up top. So the idea that solves it, that does solve a problem, which people raise, which is when we're stipulating the contract and we're saying, oh, the anticipated return on the investment is fill in the blank. So in my example with the wine shop, we said it's 20%, and then 10 for you, 10 for me. That's all cool, except if you and I both know there's no way in heck this thing could possibly return 20% on our investment. Then it becomes a problem. So then it just becomes like it's an obvious sham, because no one ever knows this is going to make this kind of, there's no way that we're going to generate this kind of money. So then the Kula Picadon contract has an advantage that we can, instead of doubling, we can just say that we don't have to split, we're not sharing the profits 50-50. You can have all the profits back, so I can say the anticipated return will be 10% instead of 20%. But it has its other downsides, and it generally is not ideal. So the way to do it normally is to use this half-half contract, the Heter Iska, and what will happen is in real life is if I'm lending you money and like, I have this business. I told you, I ran this hedge fund that was doing hard money lending. So we lend money to people who are basically building houses, whatever it is, and owning these houses. So there was, like in anything, like when you go to the bank and you get your mortgage, it's like a lot of pages. So with all the other pages, there was a separate, we had a line in the agreements with the mortgage documents that said the loan that we're extending here is, subject, if where applicable, that was a line, it was, where applicable, this loan is subject to our ISCA documentation on file. And we had this basic thing on file. And the where applicable was, because the opening sentence was, if the borrower is like a Jewish person. So then if So sometimes people were like, whoa, what the heck, what is that supposed to, what is that funny word? We would say, oh, it doesn't apply to you. And then if they would say, well, how do I know? Then we'd show them that there's going to fall, and it would like exclude them. And then if we had a real, we knew full well we're lending, so we didn't always know who's, you don't know who's Jewish, who's not Jewish. If we knew we're lending to a Jewish person, we'd talk, I have a separate heads, a contract like this, they would sign, and just like this one says, this thing supersedes everything else, we'd specify exactly in this contract what's going on, so it'd be an iska done, iska type loan, and that would be glut, because I'm really talking, we are providing them with capital to go into business to develop real estate, so that would be within the spirit of the law, even. But we structured instead of as a loan, because we were charging, you know, we wanted a fixed return on our money, we wanted our 18% or whatever, usurious, whatever the word is, interest rates, so we put in the ISCA contract that we were anticipating this fabulously high return. That's how it was. So, okay, so that's good. Questions? We're good for Hector ISCA. Okay, very good. So then, oh, and bottom line is, so you can, halakha l'maisa, if you are in a situation where you're extending loans, you can just, this is a great book, it's on the shelves all over the place, just photocopy, write this and fill in the blanks. Perfectly fine.
So if the guy ends up losing the money, what is the story?
Doesn't
have to pay that
money? Okay, so he does have to pay back the money because, well, remember, he's agreeing ahead of time that if the borrower is saying this, if I claim that I've lost the money,
right.
So I'll have to support my claim with witnesses. Two kosher witnesses.
Or now,
with the usual structure, this one it was two kosher witnesses on the principal, and the swearing was on the prophet. But anyways, yeah, so that's very hard to do. In other words, indeed. Rav Moshe, if you remember,
why don't you just have like an accounting, what's going on? I mean, like, Hashem, what money went to what?
Well, because he's agreeing ahead of time that...
It's like he used PayPal or something.
No, but we're agreeing, because I'm telling...
Show the receipt, that's our proof.
No, I'm telling you, that because they're agreeing ahead of time that level of proof is not acceptable to the provider of capital. I'm allowed to do that. When I lend money, I don't have to agree.
So the level of proof is a witness?
They're agreeing to that, two witnesses. And Rav Moshe said, and that's the incorporation of this contract, there should be witnesses that are acceptable to an Orthodox based in, because people will lie. The point is, the private capital doesn't want to be on the hook for them, doesn't want to hear about losses. So he's making the standard of proof very, very high.
And if it's such an unreasonable, you know, requirement...
It can't be so unreasonable.
It's still legal, I mean...
What?
If it's unreasonable...
It's not unreasonable. I'm just saying, if you want to claim the money was lost... Then you're going to have to bring two kosher witnesses. What's so unreasonable about that? It's not so unreasonable. It's just unlikely, because it's hard to get someone who's going to really know what happened, who's watching the business. So it's hard to find.
Well, in theory, if you had two other guys with you investing and they saw what was going on, so you had two.
But I'm just remember
it's not
what. No, it's not impossible. But just correct. But remember where we're going with this. We, even though it's structured as a loan where the person's on the hook for half the loss. When they're agreeing on day one, they're using this as a way to get around the problem of ribis. So they're like any loan. They're saying the lender is anticipating to get principal plus return. So he's saying I'm not accepting any claim of loss other than a very high standard. Doesn't have to. By the way, there's when I regular business dealing today, you do, like when you investment banking dealing, the provider of capital who may be charging interest or partnership or both can put all sorts of demands, like we insist, you know, we will not accept, we insist the accountant should be from a particular firm, or we insist that, you know, whatever it is, we can insist of all sorts of standards demanding, you know, we don't want to hear about losses unless you can, we're putting all sorts of protections to make sure that we don't, you
know, as long as it's possible,
right? And they're for example, the it's an interest of the lender to make it as difficult as possible, obviously, because he doesn't want to get. So the post can do talk about how, for example, specifying two witnesses that certainly wouldn't know would be forbidden. For example, in other words, we say, you know, and the witnesses have to be, you know, my Aunt Gertrude who lives in Timbuktu. Well, obviously, Aunt Gertrude's had nothing to take any testimony because she lives in Timbuktu. So that would not be acceptable, for example.
One
so,
black person, one white person.
The post can talk about setting up witnesses who are far away, because if they're far away, how could they possibly know? Because your point is well taken, that if, you know, there's a secretary in the office, you know, and there's a business manager and an accountant, those people could act as, they could swear, I'm the accountant, I didn't know every receipt, I'm telling you, there was a loss. So, because of that, you know, but, yeah.
What about the whole credit card, like they have in red in banking? How How is that not fall into this category?
I'm not, I just don't understand your question.
Somebody goes over.